It's time for Let's Talk Money.
Good afternoon, Chattanooga. You're listening to Let's Talk Money with Jim Clayton. With me this afternoon, co-hosting Paul Broyles, 267-1023 is our number. We start our market day. Dow Jones average sits at 33,439, down 179. S&P at 4,257, down 16. Paul, this baby's been down for like 3 weeks.
Just brutal. Painful to watch.
I'm starting to get upset. All right, we got two guests this afternoon. First, with the Conversant Group is John Smith, and with Chambliss, Bonner, and Stoffel, Cal Marshall. The subject today is one of which I know almost nothing, cybersecurity. First, let me ask you this, John. Who should be concerned about what we're fixing to talk about?
Everyone. Absolutely everyone.
This is a way bigger deal than I think the general public realizes, isn't it?
It is. Despite the enormous amount of press, it still is.
Yeah, there's a lot of press out there. But when we think of cybersecurity, because in the preview and meeting that we were in a few minutes ago, John, you were talking about the fact that the targets, for the most part, I mean, the sophisticated people that are doing cyber breaches out there, who runs that gamut? Who are these people? Las Vegas, we saw last week, casinos hacked. Who's doing the hacking and why?
Yeah, if you've read the press at all, there's a hacking group actually known as Scattered Spider. And so there are actually numerous threat actor groups and gangs around the world. But Scattered Spider is an interesting one to actually talk about. And in the context of Vegas, I believe if you've read the press, you will note that Scattered Spider was involved in that event. What's interesting about their behaviors in particular in comparison to what other threat actor groups have done in the past is that they are particularly more destructive than any of those in the past. And also, they are quite more sophisticated, meaning it's far more difficult to actually get them out of your environment than before.
When you say destructive, how do they do? I mean, I've always thought of them just as being able to hack into your data, be able to expose you to XYZ, and you give them so much money and they go away. Is it more than that now?
Oh, it's far more than that. Actually, they do what's called exfiltration, which is actually stealing your data. And they leverage the theft of your data as well as the destruction of your data to basically force you to pay a ransom. And so when we say destruction of data, we often mean that they've encrypted the data or they've deleted the data. And I would tell you in the context of what Scattered Spider is doing and what we have seen them do ourselves is they are far more willing to actually prevent you a path to recovery. Before, most TA gangs were very financially motivated, solely financially motivated, and they ran their model. So the goal was to have customer service and allow you a path to recovery. Scattered Spider is not like that. They, frankly, if they get any inkling whatsoever that you are not going to pay a ransom, they have no problem simply hitting delete.
So how do you guys know it's Scattered Spider? Are there footprints, markers? Do they claim responsibility? How would you know a particular group?
Yeah, so that's done through a process called data forensics. So there's usually at least four parties involved in a breach. It's usually the cyber liability carrier along with the breach counselor, a data forensics partner, and usually a recovery partner. And there might be sometimes a fifth party, which is also a ransom negotiator. But the data forensics partner is the one that usually does attribution, if attribution is done at all.
And in essence, one of the things you were sharing with me, too, John, was that these people are talented. They're smart. They're conversant. They speak perfect English. They're bright. They were in the top of their schoolrooms. They were the head of the class. They were the valedictorians. These are not a bunch of dumb-by people, are they?
No. In the context of Scattered Spider, I would also say you ask me how we know, how do we attribute a breach. They also brag. So they also will brag on the dark web about their hacks and what they've done and the damage they've caused and what data they've got. And so that's also how we know, is by what group is taking claiming the breach. Also, I would say, yes, in the context of your question, yes, they are very smart. I often don't like to call them sophisticated because I think the behaviors, actually the things they're actually leveraging to take advantage of companies and actually gain initial access, I would argue, are largely not that sophisticated, But they are, in fact, very smart in that they know how to put their tentacles everywhere in an environment so they can stay persistent in that environment. That in that context, they are very smart, and they certainly are very smart in how they manipulate organizations or back them into a corner.
Hey, Cal, could you walk us through how Chambliss works with John's firm?
Sure. So in an instance, so we're really kind of talking here about cyber incidents. So in a cyber incident, oftentimes, we'll be brought in by the client, to assist in an incident. And so what we do is help direct the process. What one thing we'll do is help direct the process of communication with the insurer. Sometimes the insurer is involved before we are, and we may actually, possibility we'd be paid by the insurer or reimbursed by the insurer, or that our client is for our services. So they may be involved at first, but one thing we'll do is assist the client in the process of communicating with the insurer to help them avoid any missteps there and any voided or coverage issues, as a result of failure to communicate with them. And then we work with recovery and forensics as well to help direct the process from a high level, looking at what the client's reporting obligations are in the particular instance. In other words, to determine whether they have reporting obligations and which specific reporting obligations they have, we need to look at exactly what has happened in their system. And so we're involved to help steer that process a bit, to hear what's going on and help ensure that, for example, hopefully adequate forensic evidence is preserved so that we can make a determination about what occurred, whether there's a reportable breach that actually occurred, because there are enormous financial consequences for the client around that issue.
Is it fair to say, John, that if you read about a major hack in the United States or a major security breach from a cyber standpoint in the United States, that it's way more than likely than the Conversant group and the group of people you work with are going to be involved in the process?
I would say that if it's occurring in the United States, we're either aware or involved, yes. And it's namely because we are involved with some of the country's largest breach counselors and practices, and also data forensics practices as well. So generally, if there is a breach, we are somehow involved or know about it.
The other interesting thing that you brought up to me that I really hadn't given a lot of thought about, there were two aspects to it. One of us, I believe you were talking about a breach in Cisco, where the breach actually happened through an individual's computer at home.
Yes. As a matter of fact, work from home has actually aggravated risks associated with a breach. And
explain why.
Yeah, I'll get there, certainly. And also, I would add another is also bring your own device. These shifts in paradigms in IT delivery of services to an end user have actually aggravated the risk conditions that allow threat actors to get
in. You mean the fact that I'm using a laptop or the fact that I'm using an iPhone or whatever it would be, the more devices involved, the more potential security breaches are possible?
Absolutely. The more devices that are involved and whether or not the corporation has control of them, that's a big factor. And so in the context you mentioned Cisco, actually, if my recollection of the press associated with the Cisco breach is correct, it actually was caused by a threat actor compromising one of their users' Gmail accounts.
Now, who would be a threat actor?
A threat actor.
The bad guys.
Any of these bad guys that are in Russia, North Korea, Iran, Brazil. And we talked a lot about Scattered Spider that speak a perfect American English. It's even believed some of them may even be in America. So the bad guys are all those guys that are actually causing these breaches. But in the context of what happened to Cisco is the threat actors did violate one of their users' Gmail accounts. And because Chrome has a lovely little feature that allows you to save your passwords in the browser and then also synchronizes those to your Gmail/Google Drive account, the threat actors, if they compromise a personal email account, could get to corporate credentials. And the reason why they're able to do this is because corporations are allowing users to access their corporate systems from personally owned devices, and they don't have corporate controls on those devices.
They're outside of the firewall. To the extent that a firewall has been created by the company, when I take that computer home, I'm not there.
That's correct. You're leaving the safe confines of the walls and defenses that an organization has built around their devices.
Now, Cal, I'm going to guess is you have a client call you, they've got some kind of data breach out there. They may, if it's a big enough business, they may have IT people that work for them. But unfortunately, something that John said to me really struck a chord when he said, people that work in IT aren't necessarily experts in data breaches from a recovery standpoint, are they?
Right.
I mean, that's the reason
that
people like you,
the case, yeah.
They contact people like you, and then you tell them to contact people like Conversant.
Right.
Because they're going to need something different than what they may have from a tool standpoint.
Exactly. Well, and even sometimes if they do happen to have the expertise internally, they just don't have enough people. They just don't have enough folks to do everything that is necessary to be done, the enormous amount of work involved with recovery, just because there's so many tasks involved. Even if they do, they frequently do need outside expertise, and even if they have some expertise, they just need additional support. So it's critically important to get that support involved as early as possible to help them recover and get back on their feet.
Well, look, I mean, anybody that's working from home or that's in a home environment and they have their internet go down, it's a major deal to just the normal homeowner. So the speed within which this data needs to be recovered and this hack needs to be fixed is critical to business, as I'm going to make the assumption, John.
It absolutely is. And actually, business interruption is the single largest expense during a mass destruction event where a threat actor has gotten in and effectively encrypted or deleted everything. So the downtime is very expensive.
267-1023, Let's Talk Money. We'll be right back.
Let's Talk Money on Talk Radio 102.3.
You're back with Let's Talk Money, 267-1023. With me this afternoon, John Smith with the Conversant Group and Cal Marshall with Chambliss, Bonner & Stoeffel. John, the Conversant Group, you're divided into four or five sectors. What is it your business actually does?
Yeah, so Conversant Group is actually a family of battalions. Actually, our practice called Phoenix 24, we actually perform breach recovery. And so, in other words, like I said earlier, the chiefest cost in a breach is business interruption. Phoenix 24 solves for business interruption by getting systems restored as timely as humanly possible. And so we paratrooper in, and we put the organization back together again. That's what we do at Phoenix 24. Additionally, we have a group called Grifo 5, which is focused on defense. What we do is we leverage the breach intelligence that we obtain from our recovery practices to actually build hardened, managed protection services, leveraging what threat actors are doing today. So it's proactive.
So in essence, with the five group, what you're really doing is you're handling security for me.
Absolutely. Portions of it. That is correct. Like, as I said before the show, the number one security control in an organization is protecting the ability to recover. And unfortunately, only 11% of IT professionals even believe backups are a security control. So as an example, at Grifo 5, we have what we call our managed backup service, which we are constantly re-onboarding our customers to new threat intel and re-hardening those services that we're delivering to them, leveraging that new threat intel so that the backups will survive modern threat attack.
So the backup keeps 100% of my data.
It should.
If my backup is secure, I don't necessarily have to pay that ransom.
There may be other reasons you pay the ransom,
okay.
But as far as recovery is concerned, if your backups are secure and you have a path to recovery, no, you do not have to pay the ransom to actually facilitate the recovery. Unfortunately, though, in our practices, more than 80% of the breaches we work, paying the ransom is the only path to recovery.
Is there a non-technical way to explain how you secure backups?
It's complicated.
It is.
Technically.
But in essence, what we're saying is we're talking about most entities have a backup system. What you're telling me is that most of these backup systems are not secure.
That is correct. They are not. And the reason why is the paradigm under which they're being orchestrated is flawed. The way we think as IT professionals is often flawed because we are not thinking in the context of mass destruction events and what threat actors are actively doing. Therefore, the way we're orchestrating the backups is flawed. So most organizations, while they believe they could recover in one of these events, most commonly cannot. And frankly, we have another group called Athena 7 where we perform assessments leveraging breach intelligence. I can tell you more than 95% of the organizations that we assess cannot recover.
Hmm.
Could not. Potentially could not recover. Their backups could be destroyed by a threat actor.
And is there any other part of your business Breach Recovery, Grifo 5, Athena 7. Is there another piece there?
There's the Conversant Group, which is the original entity. That's where we do traditional mitigation services. So we are also doing defense there as well. It's just delivered in a more traditional path.
I guess philosophically, the thing that I picked up in the conversation with you is that most people think of security breaches, and I would imagine at your law firm it'd be exactly the same thing, Cal, is that most of these breaches take place because an employee hits the wrong button. And therefore, the problem is the uneducated employee. It's not the case, is it, John?
Not all the time.
It can happen, but it's not how you solve the biggest portion of the problem.
Yeah, I would say there has been an over-focus and an over-reliance on security awareness training. I am not undermining the importance of security awareness training, but humans will always be fallible. And so the onus is really on IT professionals to actually harden systems in a manner that actually prevents user behavior from causing damage. The underlying cause is not really that the user clicked the wrong button or opened the wrong attachment. It is that IT didn't orchestrate the systems in a manner to prevent that behavior from causing damage. And oftentimes, the controls could have prevented that behavior from causing damage. They simply are not being orchestrated in that way.
What percentage of clients would pick up the phone and call you and say, look, I'm concerned about how we're managing cybersecurity? Do most of them call you after they've had a breach? Or do they call you saying, how do we solve this issue?
Well, they call us for a variety of reasons. Sometimes they do call us because they've had a breach and need help in the recovery and notification effort and assessing all their legal responsibilities. But sometimes they also call us because their businesses within specific industries, they know that there are regulations that cover them and that they have certain obligations.
Medical
under HIPAA. And so they come to us, you know, knowing they have those obligations for advice on how to comply with those, sort of what do we need to put in place? Because there's a variety of things. I mean, one, obviously, you want to be practically in a place where you have good security, regardless of what boxes you've checked. But from a regulatory perspective, there are some specific things you have to do. And they're good practices in general. But there are some specific things you have to do. For example, under HIPAA, organizations have to conduct a risk assessment of their security, of their data environment, and manage risks based on, you know, what they find. In addition to having policies covering various issues, including privacy, security, and breach notification in the event of an incident.
So in essence, what you're informing your client with is, here's what your legal responsibilities are relative to this breach.
Yes.
What you're doing is fixing it, John.
We're fixing
it. Yeah.
Or preventing it.
Hopefully preventing it with one group of people, but if I'm assuming that a lot of people call you to fix it than prevent it.
An old friend once told me that people learn one of two ways, pain or vision, and unfortunately most choose pain. I guess I'm here asking you all, well, the listeners, don't choose pain. There is a path here that doesn't involve extreme pain. That's a horrible way to learn a lesson.
Hey, Cal, you mentioned if someone pays a ransom, they have to sort of keep it between the ditches from a compliance perspective, because mm-hmm. there could be sanctions, or
yes.
they could do it wrong, so to speak, unintentionally.
Yeah, I mean, one of the issues when you're in a situation where you feel that you either have to or want to pay a ransom because that seems to be the most practical course in the situation. One of the things you want to do before you pay is assess the potential that you could be paying an individual organization on a U.S. sanctions list. You could run the risk of very substantial fines under U.S. sanctions law. The Office of Foreign Assets Control within the U.S. Department of Treasury administers a number of different sanctions lists, and it's not always easy or clean determining, you know, is an organization that I'm dealing with or an individual that I'm dealing with tied to one of these sanctioned individuals or entities. But what you want to do is, in those situations, have a ransom negotiator involved to help you assess, you know, as well, you know, also utilizing resources from your, you know, IT forensics, recovery, everybody that's involved to look at all the data, all the evidence that is available in a particular situation to determine who do we think we're dealing with here. The patterns, the communication style, looking at all those sorts of things to assess, do we think this is someone, you know, do we, number one, are we pretty sure who this is? Who do we think this is? You know, what's the likelihood that they're on a sanctions list and that I may run afoul of one of the laws around these sanctions issues? And at the end of the day, although there aren't guarantees, those assessments can be very helpful to you in making a decision and balancing the risks, consulting all that evidence, talking to legal counsel about what your risks, what your fine risks are, and at the end of the day, making a decision. And there are some instances, and I think John touched on this earlier, where, you know, a ransom is really the only way out. So there aren't a lot of great options.
John, let me ask you this. If you got business owners listening to this show, what do they do? How do they approach this? I mean, obviously, one way is just to hire a firm like yours and make sure it's safe. But what are the general things that are going on? Why is all of this happening? Well, I know the bad guys are doing it. What are the good guys not doing?
The good guys are not defending their ability to recover. So as a business owner, you have got to be very confident in your path to recovery. I can tell you all definitions for most organizations do not hold up in the context of mass destruction. Having what is called a recovery time objective, which means how fast can I recover of anything less than a week, is unrealistic oftentimes in a mass destruction event. And so making sure that you are confident in your ability to recover, and it's going to frankly require an external party to advise you on breach context. Without it, your IT staff are not going to have the data because they're not involved in breaches. They simply cannot get the data from what sources are available on the internet, even from the press. It's not good enough. They are not going to have the information. So that's problem number one. And item number two is listen to your IT folks. Systems by default are open. They're open by default and closed by exception. The paradigm must change. It must change to closed by default and open by exception, meaning that systems are closed by default, meaning behaviors that could allow a threat actor to get in are not possible because IT is blocking them by default.
And the reason they don't block them is why?
User inconvenience and often leadership frustration. Usually leadership is often the problem. Leadership is not governing their organization and their internal IT departments and their consultants in a manner that encourages them to do defense well.
Is that mainly because they have not previously experienced the pain?
That is a very good point you make. Actually, you've written a study about this very thing. I think most IT leaders, IT professionals, and also organizational leaders are generally overconfident in their security programs. And there's a few reasons for this, but one of them is that they've never experienced a breach.
I was going to say, they just, you know, if you've never been an executive of a will, it's a new experience. And in this case, as many breaches as there have been out there, there are a lot of entities out there that have not suffered a serious breach. Therefore, they believe that their security protocols are sound.
Yeah, just because you haven't been in a breach doesn't mean your security program's working. It's not if, but when. It will happen. And when it does, how quickly can you recover? Protecting your ability to recover is the single most important security control you can invest in.
But if you haven't experienced the pain, sometimes the loudest voices, the loudest considerations from within the organization are folks, you know, objecting to certain security measures.
Simply so, because you're making it more difficult for them to be able to do what they want to do within the framework of the internet. And the internet is not a nice guy, is it, John?
No, the internet is a very dangerous place. So is joining public Wi-Fi. As one example.
It takes leadership within organizations and understanding these risks and appreciating them, you know, in order to have the perspective to push back sometimes on some of those objections that are based on convenience.
267-1023, Let's Talk Money. We'll be right back.
Let's Talk Money. Talk Radio 102.3.
You're back with Let's Talk Money, 267-1023. With me this afternoon, John Smith and Cal Marshall. Cal, the client calls you, and they've had some type of breach. Walk me through the process.
Sure. One of the first things I'm going to want to know and going to want to talk to them about is, have you notified your, who is your insurer? Do you have cyber liability insurance? Have you notified your insurer? Because I'm going to want to get in touch with them as soon as possible to find out.
What percentage of people have versus don't have cyber liability insurance?
These days, I think a pretty large percentage of organizations do have it, particularly in heavily regulated industries. Outside of more regulated industries, perhaps not as prevalent, but I do see it with most organizations and most clients.
If you're a smaller employer, maybe 5 to 50 employees, local, if you don't have cyber liability protection, do you become your own insurance company? You end up self-funding a lot of these potential damages?
Now, obtaining cyber liability insurance for a very small organization, can be difficult, not just because of the cost of the policy, but because of the cost of some of the safeguards and some of the measures you're going to need to put in place to get coverage. So it can be costly. But without it, yes, you do run the risk of incurring some pretty significant costs. Now, if you're not, if you're in a regulated industry, those costs can be, enormous. That much bigger because of your breach notification, additional breach notification obligations. If you're outside of a fairly heavily regulated industry like healthcare, banking, finance, et cetera, you could still just incur enormous damage to your organization. And if the data of your employees or other individuals is compromised, you still have notification obligations. So, you could still have, although the cost might be a little less, and sometimes in those situations, they can still be very significant.
Cal, talk about cost in general.
Sure. And I think you...
Mainly to pass along to the listener how expensive this can be if you end up in one of these situations.
Sure. So I think to understand costs, there are a number of things you want to look at, categories of costs, all the various parties that you need. Well, you need legal counsel. You want to pay for a law firm. You will need most likely an IT recovery vendor, and there'll be costs associated with IT recovery vendor. You may need IT forensics, and there's costs associated with that. You may need some PR help because you're going to be facing enormous pressure in some instances from clients. They're going to be calling you, why are you offline? I need this. And they may have a lot of questions. If you're a vendor to a number of organizations, they may be calling with a lot of questions that are difficult.
Or just bad PR in general. Let's say a Target or somebody like that took an enormous hit from a public relations standpoint.
Yeah. There's of course material costs associated with just things you have to replace or additional things you have to purchase along the way. And then there's notification costs. The cost of notifying individuals that are affected. And let's just say, for example, if you're a healthcare organization and you suffer a breach in EMR or some other repository that has the data of tens of thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of patients in it, and all of that data was breached, or you're not able to determine if someone got into that data repository, you're not able to determine with much confidence what was exfiltrated or looked at and what wasn't, you're going to be faced with a situation where you'll need to incur the cost of notifying all those individuals, potentially providing credit monitoring and other things, call center costs. Multiply the number of individuals involved by even a small cost of notifying them and providing that credit monitoring, say a few dollars, and the costs are enormous. Mm-hmm. You can run into the many millions very, very quickly. Just on that cost alone. And of course, we have a lot of other categories of costs here, too.
John, do you remember the Home Depot breach? And as I understand it, it largely was perpetrated by an heating and air contractor. You remember some of those details? In other words, a third-party vendor wasn't an employee necessarily. But those kind of risks, right? You could even have what you feel like is defensive, proactive measures in place. And then some contractor we work with the bad guys somehow get through their system to Home Depot in this case, and it's a disaster.
I'm really glad you actually bring up third-party risk because a lot of organizations' leaders are trying to defer their responsibilities to cloud providers and other third parties. The reality is that many SaaS providers that you're entrusting to with your data and your applications execution and orchestration also are not safeguarding against mass destruction. So we've actually worked multiple breaches with multiple SaaS providers, multiple managed services providers who did not have adequate controls, and their only path to recovery was to also pay a ransom.
So when I say my stuff's in the cloud...
Cloud does not equal safe.
Yes, that's exactly right, because whoever I've got it with in the cloud better have the right protocols in place or I'm not safe.
Absolutely, and it becomes far more difficult for you as a purchaser of those services to truly understand how they're orchestrating their own controls and whether they truly are a safe organization to entrust your data to.
Do you know the difference between the good ones and the bad ones?
I've assessed a number of these SaaS providers, and if you bought an assessment with us, I would certainly tell you in your assessment, yes. So we've assessed many third parties that are commonly used.
This is how you ought to do it. This is how you ought to back it up. This is who you ought to use, who you ought to store with. These are the protocols that you ought to be doing in your business on a daily basis and are not doing, and this is how you need to limit access from the standpoint of your employees, and you ain't taking no for an answer.
Absolutely, and I will tell you that is why it is so important to understand the breach context. You cannot get these things right without breach intelligence, truly knowing what threat actors are doing. And so I mentioned our Athena 7 group earlier. What really differentiates our assessment practices in the marketplace is that we are assessing you technically against what threat actors are actively doing right now and telling you whether your controls will hold up, whether your data will survive, and whether your third parties that you've chosen to store data with are actually doing it in a manner that's safe.
Yeah, and the other thing you're saying is that it's as if you're playing a football game on a particular day and you get 3 points for a field goal, you get 7 points for a touchdown. Then you're playing next week's and you get 5 points for a field goal and 4 points for a touchdown. And because in essence, what you're saying, these guys are changing. These guys are smart and they're changing protocols on an ongoing basis. And what all the parameters you assessed by 6 months ago, many of them may not be the same thing today.
Absolutely. I can tell you they've drastically shifted in the past 90 days due to Scattered Spider, right? What we assessed against 12 months ago is drastically different than what we're assessing against today.
267-1023, Let's Talk Money. We'll be right back.
Let's Talk Money. Talk Radio 102.3.
You're back with Let's Talk Money, 267-1023. John, I want to ask you very quickly. I asked it during the break, but I want to get it out on air. You own a small business. You got a lot of different balls in the air. You're just trying to get from point A to B and survive the economic process, inflation, and everything on. Is there a situation where there's maybe two or three things that I could do different that would probably give me 90% of the security I need?
Absolutely. So firstly, protect your ability to recover. And this often is going to require a third party that understands breach context. Secondly, protect your passwords. Implement multi-factor authentication on all your usage of credentials and store your credentials in a safe place. Generally, this does not mean storing your passwords in cloud password vaults. I would tell you in today's context with what your largest risks are, your passwords are frankly safer written on paper and stored in a safe than they are stored digitally. And thirdly, I would say protect your endpoint. You need good, solid endpoint controls.
What do you mean by endpoint?
Your workstation, your computer, your actual laptop or desktop needs solid endpoint controls, such as CrowdStrike is a very popular endpoint detection and response product, having a good control on it.
How do you handle people working remotely?
Working remotely is far more complex than we all want to believe, but you've got to thoroughly inspect all traffic that's also occurring, leaving the laptop and entering the laptop while it's sitting at home. That is a far more complicated technical solution. It requires other controls.
That's actually interesting. It's more complicated to protect your personal life than it is your business, isn't it?
It is far more complicated to protect your personal life. because most individuals cannot and will not pay for corporate-like controls. Most investment is occurring to security controls that are purchased by enterprises. Individuals, there aren't good options, but there are some simple things you can do personally, such as implementing multi-factor authentication on your Gmail account, on your Hotmail account, on your Yahoo Mail account, implementing multi-factor authentication on your banking accounts, making sure that all those things have different passwords. You should not use the same password on those differing accounts. And lastly, don't join public Wi-Fi.
So you hit the three or four things there that if you were doing those three or four things, the likelihood that you're going to have a breach has got to be infinitely lower.
I wouldn't say infinitely, but definitely lower.
Much lower.
Much lower.
Think of all the hipsters in the coffee shops in Chattanooga today on public Wi-Fi, and you just said don't do that.
Don't do it. Join your personal hotspot off of your cellular phone. That is far safer.
People just don't know what they don't know.
But it's learnable, right?
Well, it's learnable, but part of what John was saying to me earlier, though, is the IT people don't necessarily know what they don't know.
Often that's the case. Yes, because they don't have breach context.
They haven't lived in that. They haven't experienced that process.
Correct.
You could be in IT all your life and never had a major breach.
That's correct.
Well, and what you experienced with the breach last year, may be completely different the year after, because tactics and risks evolve over time.
And just because you've had a breach doesn't mean you're not going to have a second, third, or fourth, right? It's not necessarily one and done.
A matter of fact, we've seen threat actors come back for more blood. Actually, we've worked one organization's breaches three times. It's often because leadership, in my opinion, believed they were a victim of a drive-by shooting. They happened to be in the wrong place at the wrong time, but that's simply not why and how breaches occur. You're not a victim of a drive-by shooting.
Not random.
It's not random.
Who's picking the targets?
The threat actors. The threat actors are picking the targets. Scattered Spider, Clop. These types of groups, Black Cat, which is a ransomware as a service organization.
And the biggest aspect of what you said is they're playing a much, much tougher ball game right now than they were 6 months or 12 months ago.
They're playing a far more destructive ball game.
Yes.
The stakes are higher.
And when you talk about destruction, really you're just talking about the absolute loss of all data.
Correct. Their willingness to delete all data is far greater than it used to be.
Guys, thank you very much. Appreciate y'all coming
Thank you.
And spending
Pleasure
time with us. And by the way, Cal, how do they reach you?
Sure. You can reach me via email, cmarshall@chambliss.com. That's C-M-A-R.
John.Smith@conversantgroup.com. That's conversantgroup.com.
Appreciate it. Dave Ramsey coming up right now. The Ramsey Show from 1 to 3, 3 to 7. Sports Talk. You'll have a great day. We'll talk to you tomorrow.